Thank you, Shariman, and thank you everyone for having me here. Really pleased that we could all be here today to speak about the COVID-2019 outbreak. I thought to begin with a bit of a personal story. You may see that I'm wearing a name tag, and that name tag is a very traditional Kemenchian name tag. It belongs to my father. This is my father's name tag because he was in the civil service for 30 years. And I'm very pleased to be in ISIS today because my father thought that ISIS is one of the premier think tanks in Malaysia. He was also very pleased and very proud of the contributions of ISIS to Malaysia's foreign policy, security policy, and hopefully right now in health. So really pleased to be here. As we speak about COVID-2019 and the outbreak, I thought to begin by the landscape of COVID-2019. And on the screens right now, you will see on the left and right of the room, the outbreak landscape. And it's also in the printouts that you received on your desk right now. This is in slide number 2. Essentially, in my presentation, I'll spend 30 minutes just talking about 2 slides, but both these slides are very dense. So I will go through at some speed over some of the concepts in the outbreak landscape, and we can pause at certain points that I think will be interesting and instructive to many of us. And maybe during the Q&A sessions later, we can also talk about the specific questions that you want to talk about, not just what I want to talk about. So the outbreak landscape, I've divided this into a 3x3 grid. It's by no means perfect, but this is how I would see this particular outbreak, but also future outbreaks as well. As we look at the 3x3 grid, if you look at the science, the politics, and the geopolitics of it, this is rows 1, 2, and 3. There are also columns 1, 2, and 3 that I've arbitrarily labeled as theme 1, theme 2, and theme 3. You may notice that theme 3 has a larger font size than theme 1. That's because I think that in the last column on the right is the bigger theme, the theme that probably is larger and more instructive for us to speak about than theme number 1 in column number 1. So we'll progress from the science 1, 2, 3, and then we'll talk about the politics 4, 5, 6, and then we'll talk about the geopolitics 6, 7, 8. Sorry, 7, 8, 9, sorry. If that's okay with everyone. All right, let's begin. The first one is about the human psychology of the outbreak of 2019. And when we talk about the human psychology, it's instructive to look at the sources of fear, because fear and panic is obviously present in Malaysia and many countries like Hong Kong and Singapore. So why is this happening, and what can we do about this? And sources of fear could be very easily understood. We can say that they've come, largely speaking, from the fear of the unknown, firstly. Secondly, a fear of possible death from unnatural causes, and also fear because our borders that we think will protect us from the foreigner or the enemy from outside of Malaysia, in this case, have already been penetrated so easily. And these sources of fear can actually, although very natural, they can be very useful in several ways. The first one is we're all washing our hands a lot more often than in the past. And secondly, we're more aware of health than in the past as well. So when you use, or when governments consider that fear is very natural and can also be very powerful forces to change our behavior as it relates to health, including things like hand washing and vaccinations, this is very powerful indeed for how we can deconstruct and imagine a new way for us to manage health. We also must consider, when we consider fear, that how do mobs happen during outbreaks? In this particular case, in this outbreak, we see a lot of calls for travel bans and quarantines. And that's partially because we're fearing the external environment, or the enemy, in this case, of another country, which is unfortunate because the virus doesn't have a passport. We're actually talking not so much about fear of another country, but fear of another species. And when we consider that we, Homo sapiens, one species, needs to be connected to other countries, other Homo sapiens in other countries to fight a virus, then the mob mentality is actually irrational. And again, this is something for governments to consider. This is the first box, box number 1. I'll move on to box number 2 in science. We have a lot of a lot of commentary from epidemiologists. Essentially, epidemiologists will study how viruses are transmitted, how fast they are transmitted, and for how long do outbreaks last. We have this term called R0 and a term called CFR. Just a quick show of hands if you're familiar, if you've heard of the term R0 and CFR in the room. Okay, so it bears a bit of explanation. R0 is how quick or how fast or how infective the virus is. I think that's the best terminology. Meaning, in other words, if the R0 is very high, it means that more people will be infected. The R0 for this particular virus is between 2 to 4. It depends on what numbers you use to calculate them. The R0 for measles means it's 40, approximately 40. So one person with measles can infect 40 other people with measles. This virus can, one person with the virus can infect 2 to 4 people with this virus. So that's the definition of R0. The case fatality rate is the death rate for this particular virus. It's currently estimated at 1 to 3%. You may ask, why is it 1 to 3%? Why don't scientists have the full number? The answer is because more information is coming in, and this is a rapidly evolving situation. 1 to 3% may seem very high, but MERS-CoV has a case fatality rate of approximately 40%, and the case fatality rate for SARS is approximately 30% as well. So you may want to consider the infectivity or how many people will be infected together with how many people will unfortunately pass away as a result. In outbreak situations, most of the people who pass away in the beginning are usually people who are older, immunocompromised, or people who are very young. So extremes of age and immunocompromised. So they'll be the first to pass away as well. Now we'll go on a little bit to talk about the public health element, to talk about maybe one more interesting thing, which is the rights and duties of healthcare professionals. Rights versus the duties of healthcare professionals. You may think that the healthcare professional at the front line will have many responsibilities, and this is true. They must care for patients, they must sacrifice themselves, and all this is very true. What's also true is that governments need to consider that they also have rights. And in these rights, for example, do they have the right to strike? For example, the healthcare professionals that striked in Hong Kong recently, do they have such a right to demand, secondly, the first rights to vaccines? If and when we develop these vaccines, are governments are ethically liable to provide the vaccines, firstly, to healthcare professionals, secondly, to their families, and maybe only then, thirdly, to the general population? There are no good answers. I think every answer will be necessarily imperfect, but these are important considerations for us. This is in a second box about public health medicine. The third one is about the history of global health, and here I will skim through because it's very large a concept for us to unpack. And we talk here about healthcare being delivered locally in hospitals like Hospital Sungai Buloh in Malaysia, but we must also consider that health is a very global phenomenon. Viruses, for example, this particular outbreak does not have a particular, say it may have come from China, but it's affecting 28 or 30 different countries right now, so it's definitely borderless. Other things which are borderless would be the export of fast food, the export of cars, for example, that caused 7,000 deaths due to road traffic accidents in Malaysia, the export of soft drinks and tobacco. All these things are transnational. So we may have global health problems, but nation states at the country level are struggling to meet the healthcare demands at the local level when the problems are very global. That's the science of it. I would like now to move on to the second row, which is to talk about the politics of the coronavirus outbreak right now, or even the responses of it. I'll begin by talking about risk communications. This is in box number 4. In risk communications, there are the 4 Vs of social media. There is the volume of social media that's coming to you. I recall a number, 500 million tweets per day. That's a lot of volume coming to us from a variety of sources. We're getting this from Facebook, from Twitter, from Instagram, from Pinterest, from TikTok these days, and we're also getting this from traditional sources of media and WhatsApp. So there's a lot of variety. Thirdly, the velocity that's coming to us is very, very high. So not only is there volume, high variety, high velocity, and the final V that's a problem is verifiability. We no longer check whether or not it's true, we just forward. And these 4 Vs that are the problem of social media, when you translate this into the outbreak situation, it makes it worse because you see lots of people forwarding lots of messages, rumor mongering, scare mongering, and so on. So this is something that the Ministry of Health of Malaysia, I think, is doing a reasonable job, aided by very well-meaning health professionals, that we should try to flood the social media zone with good information and verified information so that we can address the outbreak better. And here I bring up the role of big tech. not only in terms of the politics of it and democracy and free speech and safe speech and all that, but also in terms of careful risk communication during outbreaks. This is my first analysis of the politics of the situation because it just goes far broader than what healthcare systems can do. But now let's talk a little bit about healthcare system responses. This is in box number 5, right in the middle of the screen. At the moment, there's a lot of responses that are led by politicians. This is great, but politicians are also led by mob responses. So on one hand, we've got politicians' responses, and on the other, we've got the responses that are led by technocrats inside our Institute for Medical Research, which, for your information, came up with the probes and the reagents for this virus faster than the World Health Organization protocol. So I think we should congratulate the Institute for Medical Research for being the leader in this particular respect, right? On behalf of Institute of Medical Research, we're very grateful for your applause. So on one hand, we've got the scientists and the technocrats and the doctors, and on the other, we've got politicians as well as the mob hysteria, what the public wants. Both are equally important. I wouldn't say elevate the scientists over the politicians or elevate the technocrats over the public. All four constituencies are equally important, but at the moment there's an imbalance. So if there's an imbalance, we need to balance it out. And that's one important response in terms of our entire health system. Let me then move on a little bit to talk about the ethics of quarantine. There is the ethics of quarantines and there's the politics of quarantines. Long discussions can be had about this, but it boils down to the question of the individual right versus the collective right. To what extent can you quarantine an individual, for example, with tuberculosis or a long time ago with leprosy, or in the distant past that for HIV and AIDS? We didn't understand the disease and therefore we quarantined them. And there are good reasons to quarantine people, but only if it's in the collective interest. The question then becomes, who decides what's in the collective interest and what is the collective interest? Again, there are no good answers. You require the good judgment of scientists and technocrats together with politicians and the people. We then go on a little bit to talk about the health system's responses in terms of the equity of health system's responses. There are three E's in health systems. We talk about the effectiveness, meaning quality care. We talk about the efficiency, meaning cost effectiveness. We spend a lot of, as least amount of money as possible to give the greatest amount of care as possible. What's frequently missing from the conversation is equity. In this particular case, there's already some rationing that's going on in China. They have very few face masks, for example, and they must decide, they as in the government of China, must decide who gets those face masks and who gets those gloves, who gets those vaccines, who gets those hospital beds. Equity is important because we cannot allow the rich people to buy their way into healthcare systems and get the monopoly on the resources. It means it must have an equitable response in Malaysia and any other country as well. Another element to discuss is the systems fatigue and the sustainability of our responses. I've received anecdotal evidence and some stories of some nurses in Malaysia being very, healthcare professionals, not only nurses, being emotionally strained by the 24/7 high stakes and high pressure situation that they're in right now. It's 24/7, it's relentless, and we must care for the psychological, emotional well-being of our health systems professionals. Otherwise, we will lose them, right? They will fatigue, they will break down, they'll psychologically have nervousness and so on and so forth. And we need to care for them in a way that's sustainable. This is it for the health system's responses and the politics of it. Now let's move on to a pure political science element in box number 6, which is about state legitimacy and capacity. And in this state legitimacy and capacity, there are several interesting angles that we must consider. The first one is about transparency during outbreaks. Well, there are many accusations in China about whether or not the state has covered up some of the elements in this outbreak. I'm not here to defend any cover-ups. Certainly cover-ups have taken place. But health systems are also very large entities that inevitably there'll be some parts that are covering up and some parts that are progressing very well. What we then need to consider is what is the transparency of that country in normal times? Forget outbreak times, just normal times. If the country is not already transparent during non-outbreak times, you can't expect them to have increasing transparency during outbreak times, because the governance model and the ideology and the political constructs of that country make it very difficult. this gives us an opportunity. If you can't be transparent during outbreaks and you don't use this opportunity, you as in we, as in civil society and the Malaysians in this room and also outside this room, we don't use this opportunity to demand greater transparency from our governments, we will lose this crisis. And I hate to let a crisis go to waste. In general terms, I think Malaysia's responses have been generally very transparent with great risk communications. This allows Malaysia's government to have a little bit more legitimacy as they perform their duties, which then leads me to the third bullet point in box number 6, in state legitimacy and capacity. Repatriation of our citizens, Malaysian citizens, from China or from Wuhan coming back to Malaysia has pros and cons. On one hand, Malaysia has a duty to care for its citizens no matter where they are. On the other, we must be careful that we can also be bringing the viruses back from Wuhan in the bodies and the physical spaces that the Malaysians will bring back. Of course, we can quarantine them. I think that's a very smart third solution, but it introduces a very interesting political science angle that we must consider. What is the duty of Malaysia's government and where do those duties end? And in general terms, I support the repatriation of the citizens back into Malaysia from Wuhan with an appropriate period of quarantine. And finally, it's the concept of emotions. Fear and anger are very powerful emotions that can unite the country. If a country is united in fear and anger, and the emotions are very intense, and everybody feels the emotion at the same intensity at the same time, it's an opportunity for regime change. China's government has got this mandate of heaven, or rather the civilization of China, going back to 5,000 years, believes that there is a mandate from heaven. You govern only because gods have given you the mandate, and mandates are taken away during outbreaks, during natural disasters, during periods of drought and famine. So this is a concept of fear and emotion as it relates to the legitimacy of a nation state. That's the politics of it. So now we've talked about the science, we've talked about the politics, we've had a look at a bit of a landscape. It's been about 15 minutes since I started speaking. I'm timing myself just to make sure that we can manage the time. Are we okay with the pace? Excellent. I'll move on to the third level, which is the geopolitics level. The geopolitics level requires us to look beyond Malaysia's borders. And to look at beyond Malaysia's, looking beyond Malaysia's borders, firstly starts with the travel bans and the quarantines. The word quarantine comes from quaranta, which is a Latin word for 40. Why 40? Because that's how long ships were quarantined outside Dubrovnik around 1350, the year 1350, because of the Black Death, the plague. The Yersinia pestis is the name of the microorganism that causes Black Death in 1350. We quarantined ships for 40 days. That's how the term quaranta came about. So 1350, we quarantine ships. Today, we're quarantining Westerdam. So in a way, right, for the last 600 years, our outbreak responses have not evolved. We're still quarantining ships. It's funny because there is very little evidence for this. The World Health Organization doesn't provide any support for travel bans because, firstly, they're discriminatory. Secondly, they don't work. They might work in Wuhan, for example, only to slow down the transmission of disease. In the evidence that's available to me right now, 2 to 3 days of slowing down. So there's no way that you can eliminate this because they're already self-sustaining human-to-human transmissions in many different countries. So this could be just a false sense of security for us rather than any meaningful efforts. We then talk about human rights and whether or not there's racism and discrimination in any of the responses or many of the responses given by nation states in the world right now. I leave it to you to decide whether or not this is human rights violations or discrimination or racism. So let's not go into that territory for now. There could be an element of fear of a rising China or some discomfort with China's rise in the Asia Pacific and also the world region as well. And finally, travel bans and quarantines will have an impact on travel and trade. Maybe I'll even make a prediction right now. The world's supply chains and economies intricately involving China. In SARS in 2003, China was approximately 4% of the world economy. Today, China is 16 to 19% of the world economy. The entire supply chains from Louis Vuitton, for example, to Apple are now affected as a result of the coronavirus in China. This may trigger the world to move a little bit to diversify their supply chains away from China towards other sources. And then I think the trade war between the US and China right now doesn't help as well. And finally, if I can introduce a concept, it would be the travel ban's arms race, or rather a group of countries seeking to outbid one another to try to prove to themselves, to their public, to compete with other countries to see who can be the safest country. And therefore, they will escalate their travel bans and quarantines in order to be perceived as being the safest country possible. This is the politics and the geopolitics surrounding travel bans and outbreaks. Travel bans and quarantines. I'll move on to the second last element of global health governance. This requires me to talk a little bit about the World Health Organization and GOARN, which is the global outbreak alert and response network. Sorry, I stumbled over there. GOARN and the International Health Regulations, which was founded and established in 2005. The International Health Regulations, or IHR, that I'll call it from now on, is special because it's one of the few UN resolutions that every member state, including those countries that are could be considered controversial. For example, Palestine, the status of Palestine is indeterminate in the world, in the General Assembly. Countries like Taiwan and even nation states like Catalonia and so on and so forth have all signed up to the international health regulations. That's the existing architecture for how we govern our global health commons. But it has a problem, the collective action problem. The collective action problem means that if, for example, all of us see a piece of rubbish on the floor, we each think that somebody else will pick it up, when in actual fact, it's our responsibility to clean up the room as we leave it and so on. That's a collective action problem in small. But when you look at the collective action problem in big, we all think it's somebody else's problem to fix climate change and inequality and taxation and outbreaks in this case, when it's actually a shared responsibility. So the World Health Organization and GOARN and the International Health Regulations are an attempt to fix the collective action problem when it comes to outbreaks. There are different definitions of an outbreak. I've used the term outbreak quite loosely, but let me give, a very simplistic understanding of the terms. An outbreak is small and localized. An epidemic is perhaps the more official and technical term for it. A pandemic is when multiple countries are affected, however you define it as multiple countries, because China is 1 billion people and Brunei is 400,000, right? So is one China a pandemic and 10 Bruneis equals to half an epidemic? We don't know. Brunei is a beautiful country. I love Brunei. When it comes to endemic, it means that the virus is already permanently present in the population, which is possible for this coronavirus. It could be just a common flu, that in just a few years from now, we will have the regular outbreaks of coronavirus because it's just one of the coronaviruses that is endemic in our situation. The PHEIC, or Public Health Emergency of International Concern, PHEIC, is a creation of the International Health Regulations. This is the highest level possible of the World Health Organization's categorization of an outbreak. It's already been declared on the 30th of January. Was it declared too early? Too late. Too quickly? Too soon? Doesn't matter to me. The fact is that it was already declared. The World Health Organization has come in for criticism, for example, for saying that it's been declared too late. But then again, in 2009, during the H1N1 swine flu crisis, they were criticized for declaring it too early. And in 2013, during the Ebola virus in West Africa, they were criticized for declaring it too late. This is an impossible situation for Dr. Tedros in the World Health Organization to declare. It doesn't matter whether or not we call it PHEIC or not. Right now, Malaysia, for example, is already at the highest state of alert. We can't panic anymore, possibly. And I think this is already a good enough situation for us to do the best that we can to manage the situation. And finally, if I can go on to two more elements about global health governance, is to say that at the moment, the patent system that rewards competition, it's very zero sum, meaning if I have the patent and Shariman doesn't have the patent, I get all the money. That is not fair and also not incentivizing collaboration. Therefore, we need to reform the patent system. The academic publishing system requires you to just publish even unoriginal research, and we must also reform that system and incentivize academics and think tankers and people in research to publish research that is original and perhaps even faster. and this comes to the private sector. They have a significant R&D capacity and manufacturing capacity to manufacture, sorry, to test for the vaccines and then to manufacture the vaccine. This is something that governments cannot do. So the spare manufacturing capacity of a giant like J&J or GSK or AbbVie, disclosure, I do not own any shares in any of these companies. I'm just voicing them out as examples, means that we can leverage, or rather must leverage, the R&D capacity in the private sector and also their manufacturing capacity. I'll introduce a term right now: crash testing a vaccine and crash manufacturing a vaccine. At the moment, Dr. Tedros estimates that, or the World Health Organization estimates that we'll have a vaccine for this virus in 20 months. Can you imagine that? 20 months. Can we shorten that to 2 months, meaning the testing of it to 2 months, maybe change the randomized control trial system, change the academic and patent system, get it tested in 2 months and manufacture in 4 months, and then making sure that we have the logistics, meaning DHL and Federal Express may need to come in, then making sure that we have the equitable response as well to make sure that the right people get the right vaccines at the right time. These are important questions for us. Finally, I'll go on to the final box, which is the biggest and I think the most crucial box for us, is that this virus or this particular outbreak is a species level threat. It is not a Chinese threat or a China threat. It's a species level threat. The coronavirus is threatening Homo sapiens. And when you consider it that way, you change the way we collaborate, you change the way we think. For example, outbreaks are one. Number two, antimicrobial resistance. We're using way too many antibiotics and we're not making new antibiotics to fight bacteria. And one day, we will lose all the antibiotics that we have and it will kill us. Climate change will also kill us because we still view it in terms of a competition between countries rather than between species. In this case, our species. Well, not so much against Mother Nature or Mother Earth, but rather against ourselves and what we've wrought for ourselves. The idea is that this is a species-level threat more than it is a threat between countries. Ladies and gentlemen, that is my analysis of the science, the politics, and the geopolitics of the current outbreak right now. We're about 26 minutes or so into the conversation. If it's okay with you, I'll move on to my second and final slide, if that's okay. On page 2, or in your handout, and on slide 3, visible on the screen right now, I would like to propose solutions for, firstly, Malaysia, secondly, ASEAN, and thirdly, global. I've divided this into two columns. The first column is the current outbreak. What can Malaysia, ASEAN, and the global community do during the current outbreak? And the second column, what can we do in the future outbreaks? Because there will be more. This is not the last one. And we may enter a period where, to use Shariman's term to me late just now, a new normal. A new normal where that we will have public health emergencies of international concern once every 6 to 12 months. That would be a crazy scenario. And if it's that scenario that we must prepare as a worst case, what can we do in future? Let's begin by the current outbreak. So I'll go from top to bottom in the current outbreaks. In red, I've highlighted what I think are the most crucial elements, and those are the elements that I'll focus on. Number one, Malaysia needs to manage our health system and human fatigue. Our system could be fatigued. We are doing the best that we can. I think that we're doing enough, and I think in many ways, just like the World Health Organization rep for Malaysia has said, Malaysia's responses have been very admirable and commendable, and I agree with those sentiments. However, we need to manage our sustainability to make sure that the system, as well as our personnel in the system, are not fatigued as a result. Equally importantly, we must manage the resources, especially the money, very equitably. What I mean to say is that we have very limited budget for our health system. We can't draw money and attention away from diabetes and pregnant women and childcare and emergency care and so on, only to fight this outbreak. This outbreak is important. Malaysia has got 15 cases cured from this outbreak out of 22. Again, not diminishing the importance of the outbreak, but we must maintain a sense of proportionality. This is one important thing that Malaysia must do. Manage our systems fatigue and also our personnel fatigue. What can ASEAN do? more channels for information sharing between countries, both bilateral and multilateral. The recent video conference between Malaysia's ministry and Singapore's health ministry, I think, is wonderful. Firstly, because we don't have to travel and no risk of outbreak. Secondly, we're testing out a new system for more bilateral communication. Absolutely love it. We should also talk to our Indonesian counterparts, our Thai counterparts, our Vietnamese counterparts. I mean, there's no end to bilateral, I understand that, which is why we must also have multilateral. And I'll talk a little bit more about ASEAN in a second, about the long-term structural changes that the ASEAN Secretariat can manage as well as we go forward in future outbreaks. This is what ASEAN can do. More bilateral and multilateral sharing of information. Just information, you don't have to share resources at the moment. At the global level, what we can do is to have political leaders stop the opportunism, political opportunism. We can provide equal statures to scientists and public health physicians together with politicians. But equally importantly, I would like to advocate for an all-of-science response. And all-of-science response means that the health sciences will have to be, well, sharing some decision-making privileges with other sciences, which I think are equally important. For example, we need data scientists, computer scientists, modeling experts, statisticians, mathematicians to help us map the outbreak. Some years ago, Google has a feature called Google Flu. The number of people who search for flu, symptoms of flu or medications for flu in a particular postcode would then trigger an alert to the CDC in America to say that, huh, maybe Google is predicting a rise in flu cases in the next 1 week or 10 days. And the CDC in that particular region will be able to prepare for a surge in cases because of people searching for symptoms on Google. This is something that we can do as well. That service has now been discontinued for various reasons, but what I mean to say is we need all of science, mathematicians, computer scientists, psychologists, sociologists to come in rather than only rely on health system specialists. This is what the global community can do for this current outbreak. Let me now park that and move on in favor of future outbreaks. And in future outbreaks, what Malaysia can do very specifically is invest in health systems strengthening, specifically universal health coverage, or UHC, and primary healthcare. Let me define the terms universal health coverage a little bit. Universal health coverage kind of exists in Malaysia already. What it means is that you get the care that you need when you need it without going bankrupt. Universal health means you get the care that you need when you need it. Coverage without going bankrupt. In Malaysia, largely speaking, we have achieved some metrics for UHC, and I think we're doing a good job. But if you invest more in universal health coverage, specifically in primary care, rather than hospital-based or specialist-based care, you can increase population health. By increasing population health, you're preparing them for future outbreaks, that they're more resilient physically, the diabetes is better controlled, they're less immune compromised, they exercise more, they don't smoke, and so on and so forth, and their nutrition is better, and therefore you're better prepared to fight the next outbreak. Perhaps there'll be a question later, and I'll drop this number to you right now. Malaysia spends 4.5% of our GDP on health. The world average is 10% of GDP. We're underspending. If we can bring it up to 10% of GDP, we'll have a much healthier population. And spending doesn't mean only necessarily in hospitals and to buy MRI scanners. It could be just as simple as free breakfasts. And that is an improvement of nutrition. Free breakfast is a bit of a controversial issue as well, not really related to health systems. So I'm going to park that in favor of what ASEAN can do. What ASEAN can do is to upgrade their health division to the directorate. ASEAN's a wonderful organization. It's a talk shop. There's a lot more talking than actually doing. At the moment, there are 4 departments, 11 directorates, and 46 divisions. Health is one of those 46 divisions. It seems a little unusual, right? Because health is so important and it may be the only thing that we should all be worried about. And maybe it should, from a division, become a little bit higher, like a directorate. And this is one specific proposal. Make it a directorate, staff it up, let it coordinate some of the information sharing that's taking place. This is one specific thing that ASEAN can do. Well, other things that ASEAN can do would be maybe more regular meetings for the health ministers, more regular meetings of the directors general of health, also to talk about migration, health security. We have a vaccine stockpile, or rather common pool purchasing of vaccines, which is great. Maybe we should have stockpiles for vaccines for malaria, tuberculosis, for example, or diphtheria or measles, and we stockpile them in various regions so we can activate the stockpiles and have resource sharing as a second and a third and a fourth step. So these are important considerations for ASEAN as well. But one specific thing that ASEAN can do is to upgrade their health division to a directorate. all else will follow. Finally, what can the global community do? There are many things that a global community can do. But I'll draw in red the third bullet point, which is to reform to enable crash testing, crash approving, and crash manufacturing of vaccines and cures. The testing of it is right now very slow. It's slow for very many good reasons, because we want to ensure the effectiveness and the safety of the vaccines and the medicines that we are making for actual human populations. But is there a way that we can make it shorter by changing the burdens of proof and the evidentiary burdens that are required for testing? From the testing comes the approval. The approval in Malaysia is done by NPRA, which is a National Pharmaceutical Regulatory Agency, which is a branch of the Ministry of Health. In the US, the equivalent is the Food and Drug Administration, FDA. These requirements are usually very high. I'm not advocating for lowered requirements during outbreak situations. The Ebola vaccine crisis that took place and how it was mismanaged is a lesson that we can use for future vaccine testing, approval, and manufacturing. Repeat, I'm not advocating for lowered standards. I'm advocating for high standards, but reasonable standards that take into account the urgency of the situation. If you can crash test and crash approve, then you must crash manufacture and then crash distribute the vaccines and cures. These reforms require us to overcome the collective action problem. Leadership could be provided by neutral entities, for example, at the World Health Organization or the European Union. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, I refer you again, if I may, to the species-level threat that we're facing. So really, this is not a problem between countries or a problem between cities or politicians and versus scientists, or politicians and scientists versus the public, or Malaysia versus, doing better than Singapore, etc., etc. This is really a species-level threat requiring us to think very differently about how we'll fix this crisis and future crises. Thank you.